So the message this morning, we're continuing in our series with the parables, and I've called the message the parable of the two sons. There's also another parable that has two sons. We could call this the parable of the two lost sons that we've just read about in Luke 15, 11 to 32. Typically, this parable is referred to as the prodigal son, but it maybe should be called the parable of the two lost sons or the two prodigal sons. One theologian has named this parable the compassionate father and his two lost sons. And this happens to be the longest parable in the Bible that Jesus gives, and it's also the longest story that Jesus ever tells. And I want to tell you up front that there's two books that I relied on for help, apart from the scriptures, of course. But there's two books that help me in my study. One is called Stories with Intent. It's a book all about the parables by a gentleman named Klein Snodgrass, Stories with Intent. And then another book that I really love called The Surprising Genius of Jesus by Peter J. Williams. And some people, including Peter Williams, he calls this parable the greatest story that's ever been told. Obviously, he's not comparing it to the gospel, which is a grand story of redemption. But as far as like compact stories go, there's many people that think that this is the greatest story that's ever been told. And Peter Williams says it shows the absolute genius of Jesus. So if someone reads this on a surface level, they just read this through the story. Obviously, it's a great story, but the more research and the more you understand what Jesus is doing here, you see his genius, his ability to answer, and we'll get into it here in a minute. But it's not just a story, but it's a story that illustrates the goodness of God, and yet at the same time, it illustrated everything that was wrong with the scribes and the Pharisees. And it's done in a way where Jesus, like only he could do, really drives home a point to them. A quote here from the gentleman Klein Snodgrass says, "The parable of the prodigal and his elder brother is moving only because of knowledge that the story mirrors God's reception of sinful people and contrasts God's reception with the frequent disdain some people have for sinners." And so at first hearing, or maybe you've probably heard this parable 100 times, I'm not sure, but you might think that it's a simple, effective story. But once we connect the dots of what Jesus is doing, we see that the parable goes much deeper. And so as I've said every week that we've looked at the parables, we have to understand the context, right? If you read a book and you just opened up a book and looked at a paragraph without understanding the context of what's going on, you might not really understand what the deep meaning of that paragraph is, right? So the same thing in scripture, context is everything. Understanding what's going on and why Jesus is telling this story. And what is his intent? And so if we backed up earlier in the book of Luke, in verses 29 to 32, we would see that there was a feast at the house of Levi, whereas Jesus and his disciples were eating with tax collectors and other people. Now, tax collectors aren't popular today. They sure weren't popular back in that day as well, for many reasons, but they were very much looked down upon. And here is Jesus and his disciples spending time with these tax collectors. And if we read that passage in Luke 5, it says that the Pharisees and the scribes looked upon this and they started grumbling and complaining, asking, "Why are you eating with these people?" And so we revisit kind of a similar scenario here in Luke 15. And it said in Luke 15 that tax collectors and sinners were drawing near to Jesus. And so I'll read here from Luke 15, 1 to 2. It says, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" Like, why are you doing this? So Jesus tells those that are gathered three parables in a row. And the people that are gathered, obviously, are the sinners, the tax collectors, the Pharisees, the scribes, and the disciples. Okay, so we have those groups of people that are gathered around Jesus. And so after this complaint, Jesus gives three parables. And the key point is that their complaint is the basis for why Jesus is giving these parables. Jesus didn't just say, "Oh, let me just give some parables because I want to tell you guys some stories." No, it's to drive home a point. So I want to highlight the first two parables. The first parable, and you can read through it if you want later, but the first parable tells of a shepherd that has 100 sheep. And then one sheep is lost, and then the shepherd goes and finds the sheep. So we have one sheep lost, and then one sheep that is found. The second parable is of a woman in a household who has 10 coins. And whereas one of the coins is lost, and then she finds the coin. So we have one sheep lost, one found. And then we have one coin lost, one coin found. And so all of these parables, the first and the second, and then the third that we're going to look at, they all have celebrations after that which was lost is found. In Luke 15, 6, regarding the sheep, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the sheep that was lost." Verse 9, regarding the coin, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost." And then in the parable that we're going to look at regarding the son, it says, "Bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found," and they began to celebrate, which is also translated as rejoice. Okay, so we have rejoicing in all three parables. We have a lost sheep, a lost coin, and a lost son. So we know that these parables go together. And the first two parables are there to prepare us for the third parable, which is obviously a lot longer and more detailed, and it's the one that's going to drive home the point. So the first two parables kind of foreshadow that third parable. As we said, we have a sheep who strayed away, and we have a coin. We have a sheep who strayed away in the first parable, and a son who strayed away in the third parable. Okay, so there's some similarities. The sheep went away in the first parable, and the son went away in the third. We also have, in the second parable, a coin who is lost at home in the second parable. And in the third parable, we have another son who is lost at home in the third parable. So something that is unique about this parable is that there are two stories taking place here. We would look at the parable, we'd see, obviously, in the first half or so, there's one narrative taking place. And then we see in the second half, there's kind of the story changes because it focuses on the older brother. So it's like two stories in one. And I'm not going to retell the entire parable because I'm sure that you guys have heard this parable many, many times. So what I want to do is highlight some unique things here that maybe you have not heard before, some of the highlights. So first we look at the parable of the younger prodigal son in verses 11 to 24. And you know the story, the younger son tells his father, give me my inheritance. And so we know that this was a wealthy family. They had servants. They had a fatted calf at the ready. So it tells us this would have been a wealthy family. So we know that the younger son, he would have gotten a good inheritance here. Now, according to Deuteronomy 21, the older son would have been given a double portion versus the younger son. You could look that up. Deuteronomy 21:17. It gives the kind of the rules for Jewish families that the older son would get a double portion and the younger son would get half the portion or a less portion. And so it tells us in Luke 15:12 that the father here, he didn't just give this inheritance to the younger son, but he also gave the inheritance to the older son here. It says he divided his property between them both. Okay? So they're both getting their inheritance. And so the scribes and the Pharisees, they would have known this. This is customary in the Jewish law. And the Pharisees, they were known to be hardworking, thrifty people, people that hated wastefulness. So as they heard the story that Jesus was telling, and they're thinking about the younger son wasting this large amount of money, spending his inheritance in what it says, riotous living, they would have detested the younger son. They would have been thinking, what an idiot, because they were people, and this is not a disparaging thing. The Jews are known to be good with money, right? And so looking at this younger son who was not good with money, that would have like made them upset inside. And so in the Pharisees' economy, and of course in our economy as well, hard work equals financial reward. Okay, so you work hard, you get money, right? That's how things work in our economy and back then as well. And wasteful spending, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. Wasteful spending is catastrophic. It is not good news if you're spending all your money, money that you will soon run out of, like this younger son. And so sometimes because of that attitude, the Pharisees, whether they're ancient or modern Pharisees, they can become a little bit self-righteous in their attitude. They say, I'm a self-made man. I work hard, I earn my money, and I'm self-made. And they would look at the younger son and they'd say, this kid deserves everything that's coming to him. So they're a little bit self-righteous, and they look at those people that are wasteful as, they're gonna get what they deserve. And of course, as we read the story, the younger son does get what he deserves. He spends all of his money, and he has to take up feeding pigs as his employment. And of course, seated here are Jews, scribes, and Pharisees, and they're listening to the story here, and farming to a Pharisee and a scribe was not thought of as a high-end job. But not only that, what is this young man doing? He's feeding pigs. Well, the pigs are the most despised unclean animals to the Jews. And so they are just getting more upset as they're hearing this story. But as a famine hits the country, and this is no fault of the son. It said that a famine hit that particular country. So it's not his fault that the famine came. It says that he was so hungry that he wished that he could just eat the leftover pig feed, which is known as carob pods, okay? Barely any nutritional value, wouldn't have tasted good, but he was desperate he was so hungry that he's watching the pigs eat, and he's saying, I wish I could have some of this food. Okay, so that's how low he's gotten. And imagine the Pharisees and the scribes considering how disgusting this younger son, how he has fallen. But just at that point, he thinks of his father. In his mind, as he's desiring this pig feed, the young man comes to his senses and he says, maybe my father could take me back. Maybe I could be a servant of my father, not a son, but I will become his servant, and therefore I could eat bread like the rest of the servants. We know that the father, so young son makes his journey back to his house. We know that the father was standing at the edge of the field, perhaps daily, looking out for his son. Where is my son? Oh, how I wish he would return. And as the son returns back home, we see that the father runs out to him. And in humility, the son says this, Father, I have sinned. I'm not worthy to be your son. And he was going to continue to say more, but the father stops him mid-speech. And he says, get my son the best robe, get my son shoes, kill the fatted calf, and we're going to have a party and let's invite everyone for my son. So we see this story as a wonderful story of a father's grace. But the scribes and the Pharisees were probably angry because the son did not get what he deserves, but rather he got the very opposite, didn't he? The son deserved to get wrath from his father. You left me, you spent your inheritance, why should I take you back? But no, the father opens up his arms to this son and he gets mercy and he gets grace. And I hope that reminds you of the good father that we have in heaven, who according to Psalm 103 tells us, he does not deal with us according to our iniquities, as we read earlier. He's a good father, and he's merciful and gracious. So that summarizes a bit of the first son, but that's not the whole story. So in verses 25 to 32, we see the older prodigal son reaction. I call him prodigal son. You might have thought of him as a good son, but we see he's not a good son at all. The older son was out working in the field. And we read about he came in, it's like he came out back late. So he's a hard worker. He's working late into the night, and he comes back from the field. And when the older brother discovers what's going on, he says, like, what's all this noise? What's all this? What's going on here? And when people tell him, he gives a very emotional and angry response. And as he addresses his father, he says, this son of yours, instead of calling him my brother, he says, what's going on with this son of yours that, you know, spent all his money with prostitutes, even though the scriptures don't say that he spent his money on that. But he says, this son of yours, not his brother. In the way that he talks to his father, he shows he has very little care or relationship with his father by the way that he speaks to him. And what is his reaction to what's taken place? Is he full of joy that his brothers come home? No, he says, hey, you're giving him a party. You've never given me a party. Why haven't you killed the fatted calf so me and my friends can have a party? No mention of his father and the neighbors and everything. How about a party for me and my friends, he says. And then in verse 29, he complains about the amount of time that he served his father, and the Greek word there actually means slaved. So he's saying to his father, Father, I have slaved for you all these years, and I've gotten nothing. But in reality, remember, he had gotten his inheritance at the same time when the younger brother had taken off. So really, he wasn't working for his father at all. He was working for himself because he had received the greater of the possessions. But he says, I've slaved for you, Father, for all these years. And as we sit back and look at this parable in light of the audience, who do you think that the sinners and the tax collectors related to? They were the guilty ones. They're called sinners for a reason, right? They were sinners. They're known as sinners. So who do you think that they related to? They related to the younger son, okay? And who do you think the scribes and the Pharisees related to? They related to the older brother. They were sympathetic to that older brother. So we want to look at some of the genius of the story. For us, the story does make a point without even going too deeply into it. But for those that were present, especially the scribes and the Pharisees, they would have felt this story on a much deeper level. Why is that? Well, because the scribes and the Pharisees were very familiar with the Torah. Okay, and so as Jesus is telling the story, alarm bells should have been going off in their minds. If anyone in the audience knew the Torah, which is Genesis to Deuteronomy, the first five books of the Bible, it was the scribes. Okay, the job of a scribe was literally to make handwritten copies of the Torah. They were the ancient photocopiers. Okay, the scribes, they would copy out the scriptures, and they had to be trained in doing that. And there were 304,805 Hebrew letters in the Torah, and they had to copy it perfectly. In that, it is known that if they made one mistake when they copied the Torah, it was rendered invalid. So this was a very serious job, and they knew the scriptures very well. And it said it took about a year and a half to make one copy. So throughout their lifetime, that's what they would do. They were just slow photocopiers, think of them as. They knew the scriptures deeply. They knew the stories. They knew the law. They knew the language. They know all the intricate details of the Torah. And the genius is how Jesus echoes details from the Torah, especially Genesis, in this parable, as he addresses them. One story, there's so many echoes from the Torah in this parable, I couldn't possibly tell you them all, but let me tell you of a few of them. So Jesus, as he tells this story, is echoing the story of Jacob and Esau. So the story of Jacob and Esau, the sons of Isaac, it's the most famous two-son story in the Old Testament, okay? There's no other kind of more popular story to these Jews than the story of Jacob and Esau. And those two brothers were known as rivals. We know that the younger son, Jacob, had taken the birthright from Esau and had taken the blessing from Esau, so that Esau actually lost everything. So Esau would have received that double blessing, the double portion, and Jacob would have got the single one. But the scriptures tell us that Esau actually lost it all, and Jacob got the blessing, 100% of it, and the birthright. And then if you read through the scriptures in Genesis, we see that Jacob, after his father Isaac dies, he goes off to a far country, okay? It's a little bit of similarity there. Jacob, the younger son, goes to a far country. He gets married, but he is very prosperous. And then he returns, and Isaac is dead, and Jacob has to face Esau. There's a whole lot of scripture you can read about it. I can't give too much of the details here. But now he has to face the brother who he stole the birthright and the blessing from. And Jacob fears tremendously for his life, because Esau, it is said, he has 400 men And we know that Esau would have been very upset at his brother. But what happens when Jacob and Esau meet? Let me read to you what happens. Esau should have been very angry, but it says this. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Where have we heard that before? In the parable that we just read. Does that sound familiar? The older brother in the parable that we read lost nothing, yet he was angry that his father celebrated the younger son returning home. Remember, the older brother would have got the double blessing. He didn't lose anything because of the actions of his brother. Yet Esau had lost everything. And we read here how Esau, his actions mimic the parable's father, his actions. So the falling on his neck, kissing and weeping, occurs two times in Scripture. Once in our parable, once that we just read about, and then one time in Genesis 45, when Joseph, after being sold into slavery by his own brothers, you know that story as well, I'm sure, after there's a famine in the land, so all these things are coming up in their mind, there's a famine in the land, and Joseph is elevated to the second highest position in all of Egypt, and he reunites with his brothers. And Joseph, at that time, had every reason and every authority to have his brothers killed because of what they did for him. But listen to what it says, what happened. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him. We know the story of how Joseph blesses his sons who had done all those terrible things to him and everything that he went through, yet Joseph turns around and blesses them, okay? Joseph feeds them, gives them clothing. So Jesus is indirectly saying to the scribes and the Pharisees this: hey, even Esau forgave his brother Jacob. He was glad to see them, him, and their relationship was then restored. Joseph, who had every right to destroy his brothers, does the very opposite of what they deserve. Yet here, the scribes and the Pharisees are angry that Jesus is spending time with sinners and tax collectors. He unveiled to them what their heart was really like. You call these people your forefathers, your fellow Jews in past history? I want to show you what they did by telling you this parable, and it should bring some things up in your mind regarding Joseph, regarding Jacob and Esau, how Esau forgave him. And so he's unveiling to their hearts what they are really like. You guys are like this older brother. So as we look at a lesson here, as we come to a conclusion, both sons were lost, okay? The younger son knew he was guilty. Everybody knew that he was guilty. You know, he obviously had a reputation of spending money in the far country, riotous. So he knew he was guilty. Everybody knew he was guilty. His family knew he was guilty. We know he was full of shame. He came to the end of himself. He came to his father in humility, and he was forgiven unconditionally. Okay? Contrast that with the older son. The older son did not think of himself as guilty. He had no shame. He was proud. He was disrespectful to his father. He sees no need for forgiveness at all. So we have one son that was lost and found, and we have another son who remained lost. Okay? Two types of people. We've said this for several weeks now. There's two types of people in the world: the guilty who know it, and the guilty who don't think they are. The Father's grace and mercy was poured out to the son who knew he was guilty. In God's grace, as we consider how Jesus spent time with the sinners and the tax collectors and despised people that were looked down upon. They knew that they were guilty. That's the type of person that Jesus goes and spends time with, those who know that they are guilty. And I bring up the name Dane Ortlund again from another book that he wrote. And here's a quote that goes something like this from another book. He says, "The precondition for being saved is that you have to know you're guilty." Okay? It's the guilty people who get saved, not those who think that they're good. And I'm afraid in our society, in a country like Canada, we have a lot of people that probably think they're pretty good, okay? And think we obey rules, we do what's right, we work hard, and all of those things. And remember the parable about the workers in the vineyard, those grumbling people, which also looked like the Pharisees and the scribes that worked all day, and then they complained when the master gave the ones that worked for like an hour. It's the same kind of thing. Jesus, in his parables, is bringing up the same thing over and over again, and it's of his grace, of his mercy to those that are guilty and undeserving. He pours those things out to. For those that think that they're good, Jesus is unveiling to them and to us their hearts. And so the two questions that I ask this morning is this: have you been forgiven by God the Father? Have you seen your own guiltiness before him in your sin and been forgiven by the Father? And number two, are we quick to forgive? Okay? When we see someone that goes off but repents and comes back in humility, are we quick to forgive those type of people? Are we glad to see those people come back to God, like the older son should have said? Or do we say in our hearts, I hope they get what they deserve? You know, if any of us got what we deserved, it would be hell. That's what we all deserve. But God, in his grace and mercy, gives us what we don't deserve, his grace and forgiveness and a promise to go to heaven and to come into his kingdom. So I pray that you've been forgiven by God, and I pray that we all are quick to forgive and see relationships restored. So that's the message for today. Thank you for listening to my stumbling voice. We are going to...